Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Good as we would like to be. You know, we got to defend. It's a tough team to defend because they got so many guys that can put the ball in the basket. Well, we're going to have 37 assists every night, I know. We got to make shots still. But, you know, the way, like I said, Kyrie was moving the ball, myself, got guys involved. Guys felt good when the ball got to them and they just locked and loaded and shot.
Last two games, I missed a lot of easy ones. But, I mean, when you got guys that are ready to shoot, T-Top does an unbelievable job of screening and rolling. Got a great rhythm going and, you know, just kept going to that same play. And then when they started to stop and start kick out to our shooters. I've been saying it all season. Our state was on defensive end. You know, when we're not playing up to our capabilities, teams take advantage of it. You know, they make us pay, and then, you know, we try to use our talent to get back in the game offensively.
It just felt good, man, coming off a good shooting night like that. My first three games back, my shot rhythm has been kind of off. So, man, just to have a night like that, it's great to get that confidence back. With me, if I see that first shot going down, my confidence is through the roof. I'm going to keep shooting, and if I see the next three or four go in, then I know I'm on. So I'm just going to, I got to keep shooting, just keep playing within the offense and within the flow of the game.
Atlanta has been successful because they've allowed Matt Ryan to be on time. Matt Ryan doesn't have to flinch in the pocket. He doesn't have to pump the ball. He's able to get the ball out as he goes through his reads, and he always has an opportunity to hit guys with a play to make it with yards after the catch. The New England Patriots' task will be getting Matt Ryan off schedule.
If Tom Brady would just start out every interview by saying, "I want to thank the Oakland Raiders," then I'll be happy. Then I would let it go. But until that day happens, I'm not going to let it go. Because think about this. If he loses that game, he's a kid that lost a home game to a West Coast team in the snow.
Yeah.
You know, so he's not starting the next year. You know what I mean? Bledsoe is back starting.
Tom Brady is the greatest football player to ever play. When you can play that good, that consistently great, year after year after year after year, game after game after game after game, I mean, nobody's ever done it. Nobody's ever done it like Tom Brady has. He's the best of all time.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Listen to Timmy Brown. Timmy Touchdown Brown. Actually, technically, he was Touchdown Timmy Brown. The Notre Dame the Notre Dame Heisman Trophy winner from 1988? I want to say eight. It's seven or eight. I want to say eight. Living in the Tuck rule. Still reminded about it. And I cannot blame him. The Oakland Raiders did beat Tom Brady. It was not a forward pass, an incomplete forward pass. I don't care if they're saying he was tucking it. The point is he wasn't throwing it. And that is exactly what the point is. And Timmy Brown said, you know what? History would have been changed if Tom Brady had actually lost that game, which he should have, when Charles Woodson on a blitz jarred the ball loose from Brady. And then Greg Beekert, the middle linebacker, jumped on it in the snow. It should have been Raiders ball. Instead, the most ridiculous refereeing call or officiating call in the history of the National National Football League. Beg your pardon. I got a basketball game on in front of me. The most ridiculous call in the history of the National Football League leads to a vinatieri field goal. The first Super Bowl, the championship, and the beginning of the legend of Tom Brady. How about Touchdown Timmy Brown? And he's exactly right. It was 87, Jim Cushman says.
Yes, it was 87 for Tim Brown. And by the way, Bob, I've always wondered, because you've made mention in the past that this was the block of time when you were working with the Raiders.
Yes.
Were you still at that point?
Yes.
Were you at that game?
No.
Oh,
I was not actually.
What a story if you'd have been able to actually been
know,
there.
I know, but I mean, I watched like the rest of America did, boy, on slow motion replay. I mean, everybody knows his arm was in the passing it. In fact, he knew there was a hit coming, so he pulled it in.
Yep.
And as you're pulling the ball in, you are technically a runner now. You are not trying to be a passer.
At least that's how I was raised with the game.
That's exactly diggity doggone right. It's how the game is supposed to be officiated. And I had to do some quick verbal dancing there to avoid saying GD, which I wanted to say. Because no, you're exactly right, Jim. The Raiders absolutely had that game won. And boy, what a really interesting couple of clips there at the end of the montage to start today's program. You know, you've got Tim Brown on the Super Bowl, and then Jim Harbaugh on Tom Brady. I mean, Tim Brown on Tom Brady's Super Bowl runs and everything else and how it all started. And then Jim Harbaugh just flat out saying it. The Michigan man, Jim Harbaugh, talking about a Michigan man, Tom Brady, saying he's just the greatest. He's just the greatest quarterback in the history of the game. And you know what? Is he the GOAT? Very, very well could be already, even if he loses this Super Bowl. But the fact that he is going into his seventh Super Bowl, the fact that he could be 5-2 in Super Bowls, and two losses that were just ridiculously unlikely. One of the great throws ever in Super Bowl history, Eli Manning to Manningham, a Michigan guy, by the way. How about that?
That's true.
Throw that in there, too. And then, of course, the Eli scramble, the evasion of the tackle and the sack, and then the duck under, then the roll right, then the fire down the middle, then David Tyree making one of the most improbable catches in Super Bowl history. You know, I mean, he could be 6-0 going for 7 now. I mean, it's just that crazy how good and how dominant Tom Brady has been. And I'm really...
And, of course, don't forget that one of those two Super Bowl losses came in the season that they were perfect until that game.
That's exactly correct, which is even more goofy, you know, when you think about it. I don't know what it is about Boston / New England area legends that I don't appreciate until way later than their greatness. Although I can't really say that about Brady because I'm appreciating it now. And at 39, he had one of his best years just this year.
I'll go on a limb and say that part of that is the from non-Boston perspective. Any Boston fans out there, I don't care. Call us up on this 1-866-240-1065. I think it's that Boston fan attitude.
Yeah,
especially
exactly.
Since they won, which is something I've advised, by the way, Bob, our fellow Cleveland fans. Don't, now that we've won one, don't be like Boston fans.
No, they never could. But you're right. I mean, you know, we hate them. We hate you all. We hate you Red Sox fans. We hate you Patriots fans. We hate you Celtics fans. And the Bruins fans I'm a little bit indifferent toward because I don't care that much about hockey. But we hate you. We hate the way you carry yourselves. We hate your accents. We hate your stupid, you know, Beantown sayings. We hate when the Lakers and the Celtics rivalry was at its zenith in the 80s. When it was Bird and McHale and Parrish and DJ Dennis Johnson and Ainge and Jerry Seasting and Bill Walton and Dave Cowens and blah, 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 blah. Who else?
That's a pretty good list.
That's pretty much it, right? ML Carr.
Yes.
Towel waving ML Carr against Magic Johnson, Byron Scott, earlier on Jamal Wilkes, but Byron Scott. Let's see, Bob McAdoo, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, James Worthy, Bubba Kurt Rambis.
And, of course, I'll always never forget James Worthy. You're welcome, Lakers, from the Cavs.
Okay, there you go. Anyway, in those years, I was always Showtime. I was always on the side of the Lakers. I couldn't stand the Celtics, and I couldn't stand Bird. You know, I mean, yes, he was great, but, I mean, I just couldn't stand him. And I don't think I appreciated how great he was, and this is what happened in my adult years. I didn't realize how much I didn't like him. And I certainly didn't realize how much I disrespected his actual greatness because you know, it's like when you don't like somebody and as an athlete, you tend to see the worst parts of their game. You know what I mean? You tend to see the things that they screw up on or the things that they don't do especially well at a given point in time, and you just discredit them because you don't like them. And I think I did that for a large part of Larry Bird's prime. And it was only in my later years as a grown man looking back at all of this and saying, my good God, how great was Larry Bird. Now that the rivalry was, and I think I also like Magic Johnson too, just because of the 1980 NCAA championship game when he played against Bird, and he was Magic Johnson, man, from Michigan State, and the showdown between him and undefeated Larry
Bird 79?
At Indiana State. What's that?
Wasn't that 79?
79. Yeah, the rookie year was 80. Sorry. So 79, yes. So all of this went down Like, but wait a minute. Technically, wasn't that the spring of 80? Or is it the other way around? It was spring of 79, and then they were drafted.
I think it was the 79 tournament, but I'll quantify.
Like the rookie year 79-80 or the rookie year 80-81. I just know that they were, the two, top two vote getters for the 1980 rookie year. So, yeah, I guess that would have been 79. Anyway, I was rooting for Magic Johnson. Magic Johnson and Greg Kelser against, Larry Bird and Indiana State. And Larry Bird just looked so weird and, that just wild shock of blonde hair and the terrible mustache. And Magic was just Magic, man. I was a Magic fan. What can I say?
And then on top of that, too, he also had the major team versus not in specifically NCAA levels because, no, always remember, we're not talking Indiana, the Hoosiers. No, we're talking Indiana State. The Sycamores.
The Sycamores, for God's sake.
Against Sparty.
Bottom line was I was a Magic fan in college, and so I was a Magic fan when he went to the pros and when he became Magic against Bird and Lakers against Celtics. I was a Magic fan. I mean, that was it. That's it. I rooted for them. Now, ironically, and maybe this had something to do with how much I disliked Larry Bird at the time, my first team, as you know, as I've talked about on this show anyway, if you listen to the show, was the 76ers.
Right. What was going on at that exact moment in the NBA?
Because I was a lifetime Dr. J fan. And when Dr. J came to the 76ers, in what, 76, I think it was, or 77, took his team to the finals against Bill Walton.
I think it was 76, 77 was the first year after the merger.
Yeah, and 77 is when he played the Blazers in the finals
right.
And lost to Bill Walton and the boys 4-2, and they blew a 2-2 down on the lead.
Right, so yeah, that would have been 76, 77.
I was 10 years old, and so I was a Dr. J fan in 77, 78, 79, 80, and yes, of course, here comes Magic and Bird, and when Bird, took the Celtics to new heights in the East, it was always against the Celtics, against the Sixers. We discussed this just the other day, obviously. And so I hated Bird because he was a rival of my favorite player ever, Dr. J. And then because he was the rival of Magic, who was my favorite player of, well, not ever, but my favorite player between those two guys. I was a Magic fan over Bird. So I never really appreciated. Anyway, my point of all this is it took me being a grown man looking back on it all and really truly appreciating how unbelievably skilled, dominant, that Larry Bird was, and that if his back had held up, you think he'd have stopped at 3 championships? Not a chance. And I know Michael came along, but I firmly believe that if Larry Bird had not been injured and didn't have to cut his career so short the way that he did, he would have finished with 5 or 6 championships as well, and they would have been a bigger threat to Michael and, of course, the Bad Boy Pistons. I think that Celtics team that kind of, they won 3 championships in the 80s, I think could have won a lot more with a healthy Larry Bird. That back giving out changed everything from Detroit, the matchups with Detroit to, of course, the matchups with Michael and the Bulls. I just think Larry Bird was way better than I ever gave him credit for as a kid, which is what brought this up, of course, is here I am at the end of Tom Brady's career. Well, what should be the end of Tom Brady's career. Now, the other legend in New England sports, Boston, if you will, even though the Patriots aren't technically in Boston.
They were called the Boston Patriots once upon a time.
Yeah, a couple of lifetimes ago.
Yes. It was still the AFL, let's put it that way.
Right on. But anyway, here I am at the end of his career, and I hated him. I told you this before, too. I've said on this program many times. In Team Tom versus Team Peyton, I was Team Peyton. I always loved Peyton Manning better. Even though Tom Brady got the best of him the majority of the times in their career, I liked Peyton Manning better. So naturally, now you look at Brady and say, well, he wasn't as good as Peyton because he couldn't do this as well, that as well, this as well. And all of those things were true, but all he did was win and beat them. So that was a significant majority of his career, and it's only now at the end of his career I'm looking back and saying, my God, can we please put into context, into perspective, how incredibly dominant Tom Brady has been. He's going for ring number 5, which would be a record for any quarterback. Only Montana and Bradshaw match his 4. He's going for 5, and as I pointed out a few minutes ago, he could be going for freaking 7 if it hadn't been for that incredible Tyree catch and that incredible throw and catch from Manning to Manningham, the 2 losses to the Giants in the Super Bowl, 2 of the most amazing plays in Super Bowl history. And I'm ready to just admit and acknowledge. I've softened, and I've actually, in a manner of speaking, kind of become a bit of a Tom Brady fan. And it's just out of mad respect for his game. And that's it. I just, you can't hate. You know who I heard today doing a national interview on TV, I heard Hines Ward of the Steelers. And then I also heard an interview with, oh, for goodness sakes, who was? Oh, it was Dwight Freeney. Dwight Freeney, the former sack master, defensive end from the Indianapolis Colts,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I heard those two guys in two separate interviews. You know, I mean, because they got Radio Row and TV shows and all that stuff all up and down to the Super Bowl. So they're all just interviewing, you know, former players who are milling about. And in two separate interviews, I heard Hines Ward and Dwight Freeney say almost the same thing. Freeney said, I have tried so hard to hate Tom Brady. He said, I just can't. He said, I used to, when I played against him, say he was this, he was that, and he wasn't this, and he wasn't that, and you know, he's overrated and that sort of thing. He said, but since he stopped playing, and since he met him and talked to him a few times, he said he's just about as great a guy as you can imagine. He's not full of himself and pompous as people want to paint him to be. Why? Because he has GQ model good looks. Because he has almost every record in the NFL, because he has the four rings, because he has the supermodel wife, he has a supermodel life. He does. And because he has all those things, he should be pompous. He should be arrogant. He should look down his nose at the rest of us peons and say, I don't have time for you people. But he doesn't. He's not, he doesn't say outlandish things in public. He doesn't get in trouble at bars. He didn't even when he was younger. He doesn't go in for all the histrionics to get a lot of other people in trouble. He's just, Dwight Freeney said, he's impossible to hate as much as I wanted to. And in a separate interview, I heard Hines Ward say the same thing. He said, I just hated him for so long. He said, but I just can't hate anymore. He's, you know, he hated him so long because he beat him. He beat Hines Ward's Steelers so many times. He said, I just can't do it anymore because he's just so great. And he's just so gracious. And that kind of a person, you just end up kind of supporting and rooting for, even if they do have everything. You know, it's like we used to say this about Yankee fans. You know, boy, how hard it must be. And Jim Cushman, growing up in Cleveland the way you did and the way I did, uh-huh. It's really easy to do this because we had nothing to be a fan of in those years. The Indians were like the worst organization in sports. So
I've always branched out to every American. Everybody was raised properly in an American League city should hate the Yankees by definition
true.
If their dads raised them
true,
right.
But it was easier for you know, in a city where your team was terrible.
Yes.
And yet you were loyal to them anyway.
Right.
It was easy for us to look at Yankees fans and say, oh, yeah, you know, wearing your New York and your pinstripes, you know, real hard to root for those guys.
Yeah, the old Crimea River, that kind of stuff.
It would
exactly.
Be like rooting. You know, the old saying used to be, it would be like rooting for the, you know, the gorgeous super movie star to get the girl. He's always going to get the girl. Gee, tough one, real stretch there. They're always going to win because of look at who they are. And that's how it should be with Brady, and I think it was for a lot of people for a long time. But now that he's at the end of his career and I'm looking at things through more of a, I don't know, from an even keel through more clear-eyed glasses, if you will, without the fog of hatred for New England sports teams, just looking at it through that lens, now that Peyton is retired, so there's no more battle there either, you know, not that he's killing my team, because my team's irrelevant, not that none of those things matter, I've kind of started to become a Tom Brady fan, or at least a supporter, at least a guy who isn't going to go, oh, my God, Tom Brady won again the way I certainly did when they stole the game from the Raiders that we talked about in the Tuck Rule game. I'm now looking at it like, you know, saying, hey, if Tom Brady wins a championship, another his fifth, I'm not going to scream about it. I'm not going to throw stuff at the TV. I might have 10 years ago. But he's at near the end of his career. He's still doing things that he shouldn't be doing. I think he was unfairly persecuted over that ridiculous Deflategate garbage. I can't stand Roger Goodell. I want him to stick it up Roger Goodell's nostril. You understand. I mean, I will get mad because the Patriots get to celebrate another championship there by the harbor. I'm not going to like that. And I'm not going to like Bill Belichick mumbling his way through another postgame press conference. And, yeah, it was a really good effort by all the guys. I'm not going
to
like any
of
it.
We're on to Atlanta.
But I will be, you know, I will not be upset that Tom Brady did it again.
You know,
I guess that's all I'm trying to say. It's very weird how late, you know, late after some of these time, you know, their prime time goes by, like I said, with Bird and Brady, but that's what's back.
And I can't really argue with much of that either, even though I've tried at times to dislike them and what they're doing because of winning and all that kind of stuff. You have to give the credit where credit's due. What I find interesting with the Tim Brown comment from our Montage that kind of started part of this is, does he have a point?
About?
Well, basically, because what he was saying is,
You mean about Brady's career changing because of that?
Yes. Does he have a point?
Well, that's a really good question. We don't know it, but what he said was, is if he loses that game as the starter, then obviously they don't go to the Super Bowl because that was the AFC Championship game. If he loses,
actually,
that game
I thought
as
that was a
starter,
divisional round.
That was divisional?
Yeah, that was the divisional round. I think.
Oh, okay, my bad. I thought it was AFC Championship game, but whatever. But if you lose that game, they don't go to the Super Bowl either way, right?
Right.
And then what Tim Brown surmised was, chances are, the healthy Drew Bledsoe gets his job back again the next spring. Or the next, spring and, you know, mini camps and whatnot. And so the legend of Brady doesn't get a chance to grow from there. He won the Super Bowl right then and there, which of course meant he keeps the job now. And the rest of this happens. What if he loses that game? What if the Tuck rule is not applied there? What if it is a fumble? And what if the next season Drew Bledsoe starts? And starts again for the year after that.
To put this in perspective,
what reason would Bill Belichick have to trust that Tom Brady is any better than Drew Bledsoe?
Sure.
This sixth round draft pick, without the world's strongest arm, without any true athleticism, as you've seen probably in those 30-30s of his combine workouts. Right. I mean, seriously, he looks like your paper boy. He doesn't look like a world class athlete. He looks like the neighborhood kid who throws papers on your porch. And so Belichick never would have found out what he did under pressure and how he performed and stuff, et cetera, until at least, you know, probably a couple more years of Bledsoe.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the whole entire course of history may have changed had that one official or that crew not blown that fumble call. Tim Brown's got a great point. I don't know for a fact, but I think he's probably right that Bledsoe goes back to start.
I think he is too, and part of my anecdotal evidence, if you will, on this, the very next season, 2002, Patriots with Brady, of course, because of everything that actually happened, they went 9-7 and missed the playoffs. Incidentally, that's one of two times since they won that first Super Bowl that the Patriots have straight up missed the playoffs. The other was when they went 11-5 in 08. And that was, if you recall, Brady got hurt and Matt Cassel was a quarterback for basically the whole year. Otherwise, every Brady team, with the exception of 02, has at least made the playoffs and the various Super Bowl appearances and wins since then. So I think Tim Brown absolutely does have a point.
That's very true. Very, very interesting comments there by Tim Brown, and it really launched a really great discussion here, and I think that's a lot of fun. Now, how I brought Larry Bird into it is only a mystery. That's a mystery that I even can't really solve. That's just the way that it works sometimes. I got a whole bunch of audio I want to get into, and I don't have time to do it at the moment because we are going to be talking more college football recruiting. We didn't get a chance to catch up with Nick Baumgartner yesterday. And I wanted to, Nick Baumgartner with MLive.com, to talk about the University of Michigan recruiting class and to talk, of course, about Jim Harbaugh jumping into the pool fully clothed and doing just goofy, zany Jim Harbaugh-type things to land one of the nation's top five recruiting classes.
Are you kidding? I want to know if they're a vet top last year. Who'd they get this time? We had Ric Flair last year.
That's a good point. So we're going to talk to Nick Baumgartner about that coming up. Here's the rundown, just so you know what we got going on. We're going to talk to Baumgartner at 3:35. At 4:05, one more story on recruiting, and I hope you're not sick of it yet, but, you know, we focused on all of the different colleges and the classes of recruits they've brought in, you know, in yesterday's special recruiting, or excuse me, a signing day program we did. But what we haven't talked about is, what about the individual athletes and where they went, meaning the Northwest Ohio stars? We were all very surprised yesterday to find out that a particular Mr. Football in the state of Ohio from Central Catholic High, who was supposed to be a Rocket, didn't become a Rocket. He stayed in Ohio, but it's not at Toledo. So we're going to talk to Bill Clark about some of the great signings yesterday. Well, let me rephrase that. Some of the signings yesterday for some of the great players in Northwest Ohio and see where they went. So we'll get into that with Bill Clark. College hoops at 4:35 with Todd Kowalczyk, UT basketball, and then Michael Huger of Bowling Green basketball at 4:45. So we are packed with guests today, but I do have some audio that I do want to get into, because we know that tonight when Charles Barkley returns to TNT on the set once again, he is going to be asked by Kenny the Jet, by Ernie, and the entire Shaq. He's going to be asked, what's your latest response to LeBron? Because the way it's gone is, Barkley criticized LeBron. LeBron went to Google and looked up a bunch of bad stuff about Barkley and fired back about Barkley. Barkley responded saying, stop having such thin skin, son. I was right. I don't retract the thing. You are whiny. And now LeBron says, I didn't hear none of it. I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't let that stuff bother me. Are you kidding me? I got all of that audio from all four of those different sources, different parts of the story that I want to get into with you a little bit later on as well. But right now we've got a Sports Center. Then we're going to talk to Nick Baumgartner from MLive on Michigan recruiting right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
6.5 The Ticket. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And indeed, we roll along at 3:38 right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, we are Toledo's sports leader. Want to continue the discussion of college recruiting just a little bit. We did a tremendous signing day show yesterday, or at least I think it was tremendous, because we got to talk to some great people, some analysts from Ohio State, from Michigan. We talked to the head coaches at Toledo and Bowling Green. But we didn't get a chance to talk to Nick Baumgartner of MLive.com, who is at the Michigan signing day event. And he joins us now to break down the Wolverines 2017 recruiting class right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, Nick, how are you?
Good, Bob. How are you?
I'm great, man. Good to talk to you again. It's always a pleasure. Appreciate you making the time. So
no problem.
The last year, wasn't it on signing day that Ric Flair made his appearance and strutted his way across the stage or the room with Jim Harbaugh as they put on a big show? Any fun histrionics like that yesterday?
No, it was actually much more toned down, I'd say. It was more, I think probably by design. It was more about, the whole thing obviously was still a show and a spectacle, but it featured, it featured Michigan more than it featured random celebrity. You know, I think last year's kind of felt like a spectacle for the sake of spectacle, you know, if that makes any sense. And I think this year's was much more about, you know, them kind of, you know, they involved Olympic sport coaches, some local charities, things like that. So it had more of a Michigan feel to it, which I think is probably better because it is a university and it is a it's a college athletic department, and Ric Flair has nothing to do with it, and rap groups have nothing to do with it. So I think that was a difference. Yeah, there you go. So I think that was the difference.
I think he disagrees.
Probably, yeah.
And got a style and profile. You're going to bleed all night long.
I don't care.
Very good.
I don't care if it wasn't university like or not. That was awesome last year.
Yeah.
And it would have been awesome any year because Ric Flair just seems to make any event a better event. All right.
Can't disagree with that. That's pretty true.
Thank you, Nick. All right. Now let's talk about the class. Everybody's got a ranking. There's Rivals and there's 360 this and there's ESPN that. And, but I think while I don't think anything is exactly 100% unanimous, what is unanimous is the belief that it's one of, if not the third best or the fourth best or the fifth best, it's one of the top five classes in the country for the Wolverines. Do you agree with that assessment based on your knowledge of the signees?
Yeah, I think that's fair. It was a big class. I think it was it's at 30 guys, so it's as big a class as Michigan's had in a long time. So not only are you getting a lot, but a lot of the top-rated guys, too. I think they had 2 5-star kids. I think they had 21 or 22 of the 30 players were 4-star rated or better in the composite ranking. So, it was quantity and quality. So I think that, you'd be hard-pressed to find, 7 or 8 more classes that are better than that. I mean, 4 or 5, sure, but I think it was certainly probably a top-5 class as they were able to get some depth and some talent at just about every position across the board, including punter. They got a punter yesterday, too. So
they
pretty much addressed everything.
As you cover these guys and you talk to Harbaugh or you talk to other assistants or other sources close to the program, do you get a sense of what the strategy is? And was the strategy different this year than it was last year? And what I mean by that is it's kind of like in the NFL whenever the draft happens. The age-old question, do you draft for need or you draft best player available, even if you're thick and really deep at that position? Do they go after the best players they can find in high school football every year, or is there a strategy to it where it's like, we've got 3 really good young quarterbacks already under scholarship, and one of them is going to emerge this year, and we got another one after that, so we don't need to look at quarterbacks too much this year, or do they just go after the best players that they can get to wear maize and blue?
I think they still had a plan in terms of, I think they're still foundation building this year. Or they were anyway in this class, and that, they needed to address the lines, as they lost so much. You know, they lost three starters in the offensive line. They lost three or four on the defensive line. So they got, you know, they got a huge defensive line class. They brought in five offensive linemen, I think seven defensive linemen, maybe eight defensive linemen. I'm not sure what the final number was. So I think they really wanted to address that. And a wide receiver, they brought in five guys there. Four of them are, I think four of them were in the top 30 in the rankings at their position. So they certainly had some areas of need. But like you say, at the same time, I think that they also, they had a better overall structure. I think they knew kids better in this class. You know, if you think about last year, that was still only their second year here, so they hadn't gotten a great jump on, you know, having long-lasting relationships with the kids. I think this year, all the 2017 kids, they've known since they got the job 2 years ago. So they identified, you know, their top targets sooner, and I think that allowed them to kind of lock up a lot of what they wanted rather early. So yesterday wasn't really crazy. I mean, they were only waiting on two guys, and they got both of them. So, you know, unlike a year ago, it was pretty hectic and kind of helter-skelter, where they had a lot of irons in the fire and a lot of things still up in the air as they were trying to get their bearings. I think they found their stride, I guess is what I'm trying to say, a little bit more this year. And I think that'll probably serve them well going forward.
It's got to be a little more relaxing, too, for Harbaugh to have a handful of guys already on campus, you know, early commits who had enrolled early as well. I know practically half of the Ohio State class did the same thing.
Yeah.
Almost half of them were on campus, and that's got to be really, you know, a nice feeling for Urban Meyer, where you're not waiting by the phone or waiting by the fax machine to see exactly what each of these kids does. Not only are they bought in, they're bought in, and they're already in school, and that's got to be something that Harbaugh was hoping to build early on.
Yeah, that seems to be another chapter of the arms race in recruiting, that the, you know, the powerful programs or the smart coaches anyway continue to do that, where they're loading up on as many, at least they backdate those signees from the previous years, get as many of them in there early as possible. I think Nick Saban had 12, Harbaugh had 11, I think Urban had at least double digits, right? So
yeah, he did.
I think that's a growing trend, and it makes sense. I mean, you bring in guys that you think are going to be really good and be able to play for you early, and then you also bring in guys that at positions of need. You know, where you say, like, Michigan's got, I think, four defensive backs in early, and they know they're going to need probably at least one or two of those guys to play. So, you know, they brought in as many of those as they could and try to get them ready to go. So I think it makes sense. It's a smart strategy, and it works.
We're talking to Nick Baumgartner, covers the University of Michigan for MLive.com, talking about Wolverines recruiting. Jim Cushlin is here, as almost always. Cush, go ahead.
And you're talking about positions of need, especially down the line, Nick. The other position that jumps out to me is the wide receiver position, mm-hmm. and they got a lot of guys there. The headliner, the five-star recruit, or depending on, of course, what site and stuff you're looking at, Donovan Peoples-Jones, and it's a Detroit Cass guy, so keeping it local. Your thoughts on that particular position and Peoples-Jones in general?
Yeah, that's a big time get. I mean, obviously they needed receivers, and they were able to stock up there with some really quality players behind Peoples-Jones. But really, if you think about it, 2 years ago, Donovan Peoples-Jones probably goes to Ohio State. I mean, if we're really going to get down to it here, Ohio State had come into Detroit, and they'd made a move, and they started pulling kids because Brady Hoke had lost complete control of the whole thing. And we saw what happened with Mike Weber that year and everything else. If this was 2 years ago, I don't know if Donovan Peoples-Jones would have came to Michigan. But, you know, I think that recruitment was pretty easy for Michigan. They had him locked up for most of the way. And I think that kind of speaks to what Harbaugh's done to get Michigan's recruiting brand back to where people think it needs to be, in that they're not, if there's a great player in the city of Detroit, that kid's probably going to go to Michigan. Or at least he's, you know, Michigan's going to be very tough to beat, I guess. And it started to kind of get away from that a little bit there toward the end of Hoke's tenure, even with Michigan State. Michigan State was coming in and getting some kids in Detroit that they normally don't get. So Michigan dominated the state of Michigan this year and kept all the really good players away from Ohio State and Michigan State. You know, Ohio State and Michigan State didn't get any of the top six or seven. I think they all went to Michigan. So I think that was a kind of a symbol of him reestablishing the program here in the state. And making sure, you know, Michigan isn't like Ohio, where there's not that many great players high school wise every year. But if there's a handful, and if you're Michigan, you probably want to get all of those. And that's what happened this year. And I think that they're hoping to keep that going.
Were you surprised at how quickly Harbaugh was able to turn that around and change that culture and get back to getting the Michigan kids that you want to come to UM first, and the kids that you're maybe, you know, not as high on, you can go ahead and have those Michigan State, you can go have those Ohio State or something like that? Is that because you mentioned Brady Hoke, it was not that way during the Hoke years or even the Rich Rod years. It was a difficult thing. You would see the most of these rankings that Jim was talking about. You know, you see them down around 12 or 15 or 18 or something like that in the recruiting classes. I don't remember exactly, of course, but not top five. And bang, here he is now, and this is his only third year really recruiting, his second full recruiting class, and it's top five. Are you surprised he was able to do it as quickly as he had?
Not really. I mean, they stake so much money into it and all the resources and everything else. I knew that they would get the recruiting level up, because he was just going to streamline it and make it more of a powerful kind of national machine. What I was surprised, though, I am a little surprised that they were able to swing back some of the areas they lost, you know, like you said, during the end of the Hoke tenure so quickly. That was the thing. The in-state stuff, really. I mean, Michigan State had a lot of good momentum in the state 2 years ago. Ohio State had a lot of good momentum in the city of Detroit 2 years ago. And that's all gone. You know, like Ambry Thomas is another kid from Detroit, a cornerback who Michigan State recruited the heck out of Ambry Thomas for 2 years. And I think they thought they had him, and Harbaugh just came in and said, no, we're taking him. And they got him. So, I mean, it was their ability to kind of flip that, without much trouble, against two programs. I mean, obviously Michigan State had its problems last year, but, you know, that's a team that was in the playoff 2 years ago. So to be able to kind of push back in your backyard against a program like Ohio State, who's always one of the best in the country, and then Michigan State, who's had recent success, and do it that quickly, I think that was a little surprising that they were able to pull that off this fast and really kind of just sweep the board this year, what was a really good year for in-state recruiting.
I asked Anthony Broom yesterday from MazeandBrew.com, another Michigan reporter on all of this, about Dylan McCaffrey, the quarterback that is in this class. And we talked about it before. There's a lot of young guys. Obviously, Shane Morris is leaving. He realized he lost that quarterback battle, so he's transferring. Wilton Spade is back. How high do you think Harbaugh is on Dylan McCaffrey? Obviously, he's got some tremendous genes with his brother Christian's going to be a first-round draft pick probably, and his dad, Ed McCaffrey, was a tremendously productive wide receiver and Super Bowl champion. What's the read on this kid, and how soon might he be ready for to be under center for Jim Harbaugh?
Well, Harbaugh loves him. He was their first pick. He was the guy that they identified in recruiting as their 2017 guy that they wanted the most, you know, I would say back in early 2015. They've been recruiting McCaffrey for quite a while. He was one of the earliest commitments in the class. So he was the guy they wanted, and they were able to get him and hold on to him. So they're very high on him. They really like his upside and everything else. And I think that, you know, how early could he play? The quarterback spot is the only spot on the field where Harbaugh cares about red shirts. I mean, they typically almost, he wants those guys to come in and sit for a year and kind of learn. They did the last year with Brandon Peters. I'm sure they'll do it again with McCaffrey. So, you know, really, you got Wilton Spate coming back, who started last year and did some things, and he'll be tough to beat. And then moving forward, it'll just be, you know, whoever wins these competitions, whoever gets themselves up to speed fast enough, we'll get the job. The one thing to keep in mind, there will probably never be a year where Harbaugh doesn't take a quarterback. He'll take one every year. He might take two in some years, to be quite honest. I think that's a spot, especially, you know, obviously his work with quarterbacks says a lot, of course. But
I was going to use the word guru. It's overused sometimes, I mean, but he's kind of well-known as a quarterback guru, and that's why everything you're saying right now doesn't surprise me, like, that he wants them to come in there and sit. He wants to spend time as the professor, as the teacher, showing these guys exactly how to play this game rather than having them learn it on the fly and then maybe costing his team a win or two or three along the way as mistakes are made, and also costing the kids, you know, some of what they can really become. He certainly is that old school, let's learn the game from the sideline first, then we'll put you in when you're ready.
Yeah, and then also, I mean, gathering as many bodies as you can just amps competition up. And I think that's the ultimate goal in this program at every spot that they have, and quarterbacks no exception, where it's going to be, you know, there's going to be four guys in the room every year fighting to be that kind of alpha quarterback. And I think that that's how he believes, that's the process he believes that makes them better, and I'm sure that'll continue. So but Dylan was the guy this year that they really liked, and they're able to get him. So I know they're excited about him, and they think he could be a really good player.
Did you have much of an opportunity as, you know, covering the Wolverines for MLive.com to look around the rest of the Big Ten? How do you evaluate that Ohio State class? We talked about how, you know, nice Urban Meyer had it to have double-digit guys, like you pointed out some other guys did too, including Saban already in-house. But at the end of the day, they kind of were rated maybe as the second-best class in the country behind Alabama. Do you agree with that, or did you have a chance to look much very close at that?
Oh, yeah, Ohio State's class is phenomenal. I mean, I think that that's the biggest problem Harbaugh has at the moment is that they're still behind Ohio State. And it's not just a matter of – I don't think it's just a matter of beating them once and turning the table. I mean, they're still, you know, 2 or 3 years behind of adding depth like this to their roster every year. And you look up and you say, well, you just had one of these great recruiting classes for Michigan, but Ohio State's wasn't as big, but in terms of quality, it was better. You know, they were able to get so much talent. So, you know, Ohio State and Michigan both had phenomenal classes. I think Penn State had a solid class. Maryland's was better than I think a lot of people thought. And then after that, not great. I mean, Iowa, I guess, had a couple guys. Michigan State, really, I didn't think had a good class at all. I guess Rutgers is recruiting better than they've been, but, you know, I mean, I wondered in years past if other teams were going to kind of ramp up their recruiting stuff, but I said Nebraska maybe got a little bit better, but it still just looks like to me that the three teams that are getting players, elite players, are Ohio State, Michigan, and Penn State. And I suppose we'll see if, you know, maybe Mark D'Antonio can turn a bunch of guys that nobody wanted into stars again, but that's, you know, you're running uphill when you're doing that. So that's not exactly ideal, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, the cream of the crop there was Ohio State, Michigan, and then Penn State. I think those were all top 15 classes or top 20 classes at least. So,
you know,
a pretty good deal for the East.
The rankings aren't supposed to mean – well, I guess it depends. There was an interesting article down here in Toledo in The Blade today from Dave Briggs about this. You know, the rankings aren't supposed to matter. You know, so many coaches say the rankings don't matter. But then
Urban
Meyer said, you know what, though? He said, if somebody's keeping score, we do want to win. So it kind of does matter. And generally, the guys who say the rankings don't matter that much are the guys that signed a lousy class. Do you put a whole lot of stock into these? Because I'll be honest with you, and maybe you do this at MLive, and so I'm totally stepping on myself here when I say this, but I'm not aware of too many people, too many publications, going 3 years down the line and looking back, like right now here in 2017. Is anybody looking at that 2014 class and those class ranks to see if they panned out? How many of those five-star, four-star guys were starters for the last 2 or 3 years and making huge contributions to their programs to justify that class rank? I don't know that anybody follows it up after the initial, you know, ranking comes out.
Oh, yeah, I've done it plenty of times, and I think that the difference there, the thing to keep in mind is that when you're doing that, you have to take into account coaching transitions, coaching changes, coaching successes or failures. Michigan had some really, really good classes that were never coached. You know, they came in here, they were highly ranked classes in 2012 and 13, and none of them did anything until Harbaugh got here at the end of their careers. And then you look at Urban Meyer's classes, and they were all terrific, and those guys all won national titles because he coached the heck out of them. So I think that, you know, the whole thing about, like you say, it only doesn't matter if you didn't get the guys you wanted. I mean, if you look at the offer sheets on some of these guys, you know, where I hear Mark D'Antonio, for example, saying that none of it mattered. And then I'm like, well, it would have mattered if you had gotten the 7 or 8 guys that you really wanted that Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State got. You know, it's not like you didn't want those guys. You recruited them and you missed. So, I mean, it's like, obviously everybody's trying to get the same top 50 players. And the teams that get those top 50 players are going to have a head start. Now you got to go coach them up and develop them, of course. But you're making it easier on yourself when you get more talent. I mean, you don't have to work around as many problems. So to say that those rankings and everything are irrelevant is foolish. But also to say that they mean everything would also be foolish. I mean, they matter on some level. You know, ranking talent matters on some level, just not all the way, maybe end all be all.
Right, I think that's fair to say. Nick Baumgartner breaking it all down for us. The Michigan recruiting class for 2017, very, very large in size and very, very deep in talent. And the question now becomes, well, what is Nick Baumgartner going to write in 2020 about this class of 2017? And how accurate was this top 5 or top 4 recruiting class? Nick, really great stuff. We always appreciate the opportunity to catch up with you. Thanks so much, and have a great rest of the week.
All right, guys. Take care.
You got it. All right, there you go. There's Baumgartner joining us from MLive.com with the class. Yeah, I mean, I would love to read it. He says, yeah, he's done it many times, and I'm sure he has. That's why I said I don't want to step on my own toes here too much. But, Jim, do you read many of those? Do you? I don't see them, or maybe if I do see them, I gloss over them, and I'm looking at something that's more current. But I don't see too many of the, hey, here's the, you know, the look back at the class rankings of 2014. Here they are 3 years in now. Alabama's, you know, top rated class based on the production and performance and how many of the guys are still on scholarship, how many of the guys are still there, drops to four. Or somebody else had the very best haul. He turned 0, 1, and 2-star players, this guy, into, you know, all conference players, that helped them, you know, lead them to a 10-2 season, where this 4-star guy is out of football. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't see too much of that as we do all these rankings.
Either. I don't either. You know, and I see less of that than the other kind of one, which is like the NFL draft kind of article 3 years later kind of thing. I at least see those. I notice those more often when I think about it, but yeah, I don't really notice them. That'd be a fun little experiment. Go back a couple years, because especially for a bigger time program, you'll recognize some of the names, and that'll help you right off the bat to tell you if that class was successful or not.
That's exactly right. That's what I'm talking about. I don't know if anybody's done that, but I would love to see it. Okay, going to take a time out here now. Again, to the recruiting story that we're doing, obviously. We did a very extensive show yesterday, 2 hours. It was our National Signing Day special, and we talked to head coach Jason Campbell of UT. We talked to head coach Mike Jinks of BG. We checked in with Michigan and Ohio State. So we always talk about it and study it and cover it from the university's perspective. Which great athletes did you bring in? What we don't do as often is let's talk about it from the athlete's perspective. Where did all of the athletes, the great athletes, go? And that's what we want to do next. So coming up in just a few after the top of the hour Sports Center, we're going to check in with Bill Clark, the voice of high school sports in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan, and we're going to talk about where these guys went. Why did Mr. Football in the state of Ohio, one of the greatest running backs, I think the sixth all-time leading rusher is where he finished, Mr. Warren, why did he decide at the last minute not to go to the University of Toledo and to head to a different Ohio State school? Mind you, I said an Ohio State school, not Ohio State, the school. So we're going to talk about where some of the great players in Northwest Ohio ended up with Bill Clark. Then we'll talk a little bit of the NBA that we were getting into earlier on and college basketball with Coach Todd Kowalczyk of UT and with Coach Michael Huger of BG, all coming up in this next hour of the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We know long term for us to be as good as we would like to be. You know, we got to defend. It's a tough team to defend because they got so many guys that can put the ball in the basket. We're going to have 37 assists every night. No, we got to make shots still. But, you know, the way, like I said, Kyrie was moving the ball, myself, got guys involved. Guys felt good when the ball got to them and they just locked and loaded and shot.
Last two games, I missed a lot of easy ones. But, I mean, when you got guys that are ready to shoot, and T-Top does an unbelievable job of screening and rolling. Got a great rhythm going and, you know, just kept going to that same play. And then when they started to stop and start to get a kick out to our shooters. I've been saying it all season. Our staple's on defensive end. You know, when we're not playing up to our capabilities, teams take advantage of it. You know, they make us pay, and then, you know, we try to use our talent to get back in the game offensively.
It just felt good, man, coming off a good shooting night like that. My first three games back, my shot rhythm has been kind of off. So, man, just to have a night like that, it's great to get that confidence back. With me, if I see that first shot going down, my confidence is through the roof. I'm going to keep shooting, man. If I see the next three or four go in, then I know I'm on. So I'm just going to keep shooting, just keep playing with that offense and the flow of the game.
Atlanta has been successful because they've allowed Matt Ryan to be on time. Matt Ryan doesn't have to flinch in the pocket. He doesn't have to pump the ball. He's able to get the ball out as he goes through his reads, and he always has an opportunity to hit guys with a play to make it with yards after the catch. The New England Patriots' task will be getting Matt Ryan off schedule.
If Tom Brady would just start out every interview by saying, I want to thank the Oakland Raiders, then I'll be happy. Then I would let it go. But until that day happens, I'm not going to let it go. Because think about this. If he loses that game, he's a kid that lost a home game to a West Coast team in the snow.
Yeah.
You know, so he's not starting the next year. You know what I mean? Bledsoe is back starting.
Tom Brady is the greatest football player to ever play. When you can play that good, that consistently great, year after year after year after year, game after game after game after game, after game. I mean, nobody's ever done it. Nobody's ever done it like Tom Brady has. He's the best of all time.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, still an outstanding debate to be had there about Tom Brady and about whether or not the legendary career ever would have gotten off the ground had it not been for the Tuck rule that Tim Brown mentioned there when he said he should thank the Oakland Raiders. Really, one of the Raiders, he should thank the officials who gave the Patriots the ball back after Charles Woodson. How about that? This thing, this whole story is filled with Michigan guys. We talked about this in the first hour of the program. First segment of the program, in fact. Charles Woodson of Michigan, stripping Tom Brady of Michigan. Greg Beaker jumps on the ball. We all remember the Tuck rule game now. It was in the divisional round, by the way, not the AFC championship game. But that's exact. What a great point. What a great point by Tim Brown. If Beaker gets the ball and is allowed to keep it, and they don't change the rules of football as we've always known them for that ridiculous Tuck rule thing, it's a very good chance that Tom Brady had his moment in the sun there. He started, lost a playoff game, and the next year, Drew Bledsoe's got his job back. But since they won the Super Bowl, obviously they go with the way it is, and Brady's still the quarterback, and bang, the career is launched. What a fantastic look back there from Tim Brown. All right, we begin hour number two right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, kind of the way we ended hour number one, and that is talking about college recruiting with yesterday being National Signing Day. But as mentioned before, we always approach this from the school's perspective. How many studs did you get? How many five-star, four-star, three-star, two-star guys did you get? We very rarely talk about it from the perspective of the players, the stars. Where did Northwest Ohio's best high school football players go on signing day yesterday? So to find that out, we welcome back for the first time in a while now the great voice of high school sports in Northwest Ohio and in Southeast Michigan, Mr. Bill Clark. Hey, Bill, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I don't think we've talked in the calendar year 2017, so Happy New Year to you, first of all.
Same to you.
We can still do that in February. Why not?
Yeah. It's Groundhog's Day. It happens all the time.
Oh, don't get me
started. Yesterday was Groundhog's Day or one of those things. Who knows?
Yeah. I was dropping my daughter off at school this morning, and she said, "Why do they look at groundhogs on this day?" And I told her, "I don't know."
Although I can say, guys, if Bill Murray's Groundhog Day is on at any point today, I will be watching it.
Okay,
yeah,
that's supposed to be.
They had a survey I saw today that a lot of people took the survey and said that was the best ever Bill Murray movie. Now, to be honest with you, I've never seen the movie. I've never seen that movie, so I can't judge it. But I don't know, Stripes and Caddyshack, there are a couple good ones up there.
Can I give you one more?
Sure.
And I don't count Caddyshack, by the way, because I don't count that as a Bill Murray movie. He's not in it enough for it to be a Bill Murray movie. You know what I mean?
Okay.
That movie featured other people more than it did. I mean, it featured Ted Knight and Chevy Chase more than it did Bill Murray. He was just kind of like the comedic side story. So, but to me, what you just said about Stripes, absolutely. And then I'm going to throw What About Bob is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
With Bill Murray. That was hysterical, sure. With Richard Dreyfuss. That was a tremendous movie. And I don't know how we do these things. We just get off on these tangents. Stupid Groundhog Day, that's why. I still want to know what person decided 131 years ago, well, I don't know if it's going to be cold for another 6 weeks or not. Let's stare at the nearest rodent to us and see if he turns toward his shadow or toward the sun. If he goes,
well, there's a good chance.
We'll say he's going to be cold. It's going to be cold for six more weeks. If he turns toward the sun, who made that crap up and why are we still doing it 131 years later?
Well, I'm guessing 131 years ago, once he saw a shadow, he was killed and eaten.
The legend is that it's the same groundhog.
They have a
special potion that they feed him to keep him alive, despite the fact that all medical science and zoological science says they have a lifespan of 7 to 9 years.
So. Yeah, that one had a lifespan of about 5 minutes after you saw a shadow, guaranteed.
All right, Bill Clark, let's get into it now. You, of course, have been calling games for Northwest Ohio football and basketball for a long time, and certainly for the Toledo Central Catholic Fighting Irish. And one of the great running backs in the history of Ohio high school football just wrapped up his career at Central Catholic, Mike Warren. And when we talked during the playoffs, we talked about the fact that he was staying close to home. He was signed with the Toledo Rockets and was ready to go and carry on a great college tradition there. And then, bang, yesterday, I was not prepared for it, and maybe I didn't watch it closely enough to know that this was coming, but suddenly he is not a Rocket, but he is a Bearcat. He's staying in the state, but he's going down to Cincinnati. What happened? When was that decision made? What can you tell us about Michael Warren's decision?
Well, based on what I've been able to glean from the different reports and talking to some people at Central Catholic, he really didn't firm up his decision until he took a trip, I think a week or so ago, down. He took his official visit to Cincinnati. It might have been a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure.
I read that it was about a week ago also, yeah.
Yeah, and he, at that point, basically said, the coaches took really good care of me. It was the best visit I ever had, et cetera, et cetera. And, it, you know, to be very honest, I think it's very disappointing for Northwest Ohio. I think a lot of people, when he decided, when he committed to, and obviously he's 18 years old and he has the right to change his mind. That's sure. his life. There's no doubt about that. But when everybody remembers the big splash that was made at UT, at Central Catholic, and around Northwest Ohio when he decided to say, I'm going to be a Rocket. Everybody was thrilled because he is one of the best high school backs I have seen in the 30 years I've been doing high school football. And he obviously ended up as one of the best backs ever in the state of Ohio. So when you have that kind of talent and he decides to stay in his home city, that's a huge story. And it's disappointing that he decided to go to Cincinnati. It's obviously, as we said, it's his decision. It's made with his family. They felt that this was the best route for him to go. But there's a lot of people who say, you know what? Look at Kareem Hunt. He'll probably be the third or fourth running back taken in the upcoming draft. And he played at Toledo. He was the MVP of the All-Star game he played in a week ago with over 100 yards. And if Michael would have stayed here, there's a good chance he would have stepped right into that vacant spot when Kareem graduated and get the same kind of publicity and possibly could have the same type of career that Kareem Hunt had. I mean, again, I can't tell you off the top of my head, I can't name one Cincinnati Bearcat that's in the NFL. I'm sure there are some. I understand it. But I can pick three or four right off the top of my head of Toledo Rockets who are in the NFL. You just don't think of Cincinnati as a football factory. And
no, you don't. And what's really interesting, if I read the story correctly, and I looked at it yesterday, he had also verbally committed prior to committing to the Rockets. He had
right.
verbally committed to Kentucky.
Right.
And then changed his mind. Was it Kentucky?
Yeah, it was Kentucky, and there were about three or four young men around here who decided to, James Hudson from Central, who ended up at Michigan,
right.
Mike Warren, and Brian Kobach from Springfield, all committed verbally almost at the same time to Kentucky. Now, Brian Kobach is in Kentucky. He's already enrolled down there, and he's doing a great job. He's working out. His leg is getting better. They're very happy with his recovery. He loves Kentucky. He's an excellent student. So he's down there already early enrolled. So he's already starting his college career. He graduated early from Springfield, and he will probably get some time next year with the Wildcats. So he, of the three, decided to go to Kentucky. He thought that was the best. And then James Hudson, before he went to Michigan, said that Kentucky, made overtures to him. So he said, okay, I'll verbal to you. And I believe that was back in his sophomore year. That's how long ago it was. And I think that's something that these colleges need to take a look at. I mean, having these 16-year-old kids verbally commit to a college, I think is kind of stupid. Because it obviously doesn't take the pressure off because Mike Warren committed twice.
Right.
And 2 days before or a week before or 3 weeks before, he was going to officially say, I'm going to go to Toledo. You know, Luke Fickell in Cincinnati swoop into town and sweep him off his feet, and now he's going to Cincinnati instead of Toledo. So the door is always open. So to get a kid to commit verbally when he is a 16 or 17-year-old sophomore or junior is kind of ridiculous, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, and, you know, because like you said, it doesn't take the pressure off. Other coaches are going to still come calling. And the other thing is, as we know and we have seen some really bad stories of, you know, the colleges can change their mind up until signing day as well. You know,
right.
It's pretty well defined, the story out of Connecticut just this past couple of weeks. And I can't remember the kid's name anymore, but Randy Edsall, once he was hired back at Connecticut from Maryland, talked to a kid like about 2 weeks before that and said, you know, so glad you're going to stay with us. And then called him about a week and a half before signing day and said, you know what, we're going in another direction. We no longer have a scholarship for you. So
yeah,
the verbal commit from the kid didn't matter. The verbal commit from the school didn't matter. Kids change their minds. Schools change their minds. None of it really is etched in stone.
Well, and then the other thing you have to think of, too, Bob, is when a coach recruits a kid really hard and then that coach leaves and goes
right.
to another school, then he comes back to that kid and goes, yeah, I told you that, University XYZ was the best university for you, but now I think University ABC is the best
right.
university for you. So why don't you come with me? And I think it puts a stain on the entire recruiting process. It always happens, and
sure.
it always will happen, always will happen. But think about that. You're an 18-year-old kid, and you got a coach saying, hey, we really want you to come to our school. Then he gets another job after telling you that when you come to this school, it's the best school you can ever go to. Well, now it's not, because now the school that's the best school you can ever go to is the one that I just got a job.
Because it's never about the school. It's about the team.
Right.
And
absolutely.
You know, as long as you're playing for me, it's the best place for you to play.
Exactly.
And ultimately,
exactly.
That's it. Hey, real quick, one more question on Michael Warren. And I know Jim Crishlin has a question, too, but one more on him. You know, he made that that visit about a week ago or whatever it was. Did he keep that very secret and quiet until yesterday to reveal, yeah, I just took a trip to Cincinnati and this is where I'm signing? Did that leak out at all, and was it
no,
not as big
pretty,
of a surprise
that,
yesterday?
Yeah, that was pretty common knowledge the last couple of weeks that Cincinnati was making a play.
I knew they were making a play, but I mean that he was going to do this.
That he was going to end up in Cincinnati, yeah. There were rumors late last week that he pretty much decided he was going to go to Cincinnati. And it all happened when he came back from his visit, as I understand it. I mean, I guess they just wowed him in Cincinnati.
Okay.
And so that, it had been rumored for a couple of weeks that, you know,
and
Luke
I agree
Fickell.
With what you
matter of fact,
way.
Luke Fickell
I
had
think
gone
it would
to
have been
Central.
A perfect fit for him to slide right in into Kareem Hunt's newly vacated spot in that backfield. Chances are very good he would have been, able to start or play a ton as a freshman back there. And it could have been a really great opportunity. But you know what? Good luck to this young man who's earned the right as an 18-year-old, now adult, and a graduate as one of the top players in the history of high school football in the state of Ohio. He's got the right to make his choice. Hope he has a great career at Cincinnati. Hope he has a great future perhaps in the NFL after that, if that's what the cards hold for him. But it was
sure, absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody wants the best for him.
Well. And, you know, Bill, you were mentioning a lot of other names as we went through there, some of the other guys. Let's start for me. I want to start with James Hudson, who is also on that Central Catholic team that you follow so closely. You mentioned he's going to Michigan. He's one of the more highly thought of, depending on those various rankings out there, in terms of defensive tackle prospects. Tell me what he's going to bring to the table for the Wolverines.
Well, I think they're very high in the fact that he's very athletic. He's about 6'6". His weight, I think, I've seen it as high as 295. I've seen it as low as 275. So when he gets to Michigan and they finally, nail it down as to exactly how heavy he is. But, he was a stalwart. I mean, all year long, he's facing double teams. They're running to the opposite side. They're trying to stay away from him. And he was still getting his shares of, tackles and his share of, sacks, et cetera. So, yeah, I think he could be a force. I mean, whether he starts as a freshman, I'm not going to tell you that. I have no clue. But Michigan's defense last year was pretty good, and I don't off the top of my head know how many people they're losing on that defense. But I know Coach Harbaugh is very high on him. He spent some time at the Hudson home earlier this week or late last week, I guess it was, just to firm up that, Jim wasn't going to change his mind, and he didn't. And, that's great. It's going to be great watching him up in Michigan, just like it was great watching Chris Wormley when he was up there from Whitmer. It's great to see the local kids, go to big-time schools when they can do that. And it'll be interesting to see how much he will play. But I do think he'll get some time on the field.
One more Central Catholic kid, Torin Campbell, is going to be at Kentucky State. Your thoughts on that? And then also just anybody else in the area that you covered and that you watched and that we all, watched progress and develop through the last couple of years who signed in other places yesterday. Any guys that you'd like to highlight and mention?
Well, Torin Campbell, obviously the quarterback at Central Catholic, he grew a lot after he stepped in when he had to come in after the injury to the starting quarterback the Central last year, and took him to the championship game, got him to the regional championship this game, or to the Final Four, I should say, this year. And it'll be interesting. He's a big, strong kid. He's got a pretty good arm. Obviously, I think maybe he needs to work a little bit on his footwork. I don't think he's a running quarterback. He's more of a pocket passer. So I'm not sure what offense Kentucky State likes to run. But Torin is not the kind of guy that's going to get out and sprint to the sideline and throw it 30 yards down the field. He feels more comfortable in the pocket. But, these guys progress again from their senior to their freshman year. So there's a chance that, he might change a little bit. But after seeing him for a year and a half, I think I would call him more of a pocket passer than a rollout guy. A couple other guys that come to mind real quick, a couple guys from St. John's who happen to be staying at home. Tyson Anderson, safety, and Mitch Berg, an offensive lineman, both from St. John's, are both going to UT. And that's great. It's great, again, to see the local kids stay home. I mean, Jason Candle's doing a great job over at Toledo, and he's recruiting the area very strongly. And kids are finally realizing when they see a Kareem Hunt or a Barry Church who plays for Dallas, that there's guys, Greco's playing offensive line for Cleveland. Guys that wore the Rocket colors are getting to the NFL. If you've got the talent, and I'm sure you guys have all heard this,
sure.
If you're good, they'll find you.
Oh, absolutely.
You can be in XYZ state in out somewhere in Montana, but if you can run a great 440, a great 40-yard dash, and you've got good hands or you've got a rocket arm as a quarterback, they'll find you, and it'll go from there.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And the same thing really is true at the level down, at high school. You don't have to play one of the elite programs in the state of Ohio. You could be playing at a Division VI school, but if you've got the size, the speed, and the talent, Division I recruiters will find you. And the same thing then happens when you are at one of the schools. Whether you're playing in the MAC or whether you're playing at an FBS school, there's going to be an opportunity for you or an FCS school to go to the big show. Even the Division III level. Look at Mount Union. You see Cecil Shorts and Pierre Garçon. They'll find you if you can play this game, no matter where you are. And
well, there's a pretty good quarterback that played at Miami that now plays for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
That's exactly
pretty
right.
Well.
And you know what? His favorite target and the leading receiver in the NFL for the last 5 years is a Central Michigan kid.
Right.
Antonio
out of the
Brown,
Mac.
Another
You're absolutely
Mac.
Right. Absolutely right.
So yeah, there's no doubt about it. It doesn't have to be one of the Big Ten or SEC or big time programs. Really great stuff, Bill Clark. Thanks for sharing the stories with us. It's always great to check in on these young kids as they pursue their dreams. We really appreciate it, and we'll talk again real soon.
Look forward to it, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. You got it. There you go. Bill Clark joining us right here on the Ticket. You're going to get a timeout here. I don't think we're going to have time for that NBA story because coming up in just a few minutes, we are going to talk college basketball with head coach of the UT Rockets, Todd Kowalczyk. And when we're done talking college basketball with Coach Kowalczyk, we'll talk college basketball again with Coach Huger at Bowling Green. Thursday is the day that we catch up on all of the local big MAC teams that we cover the closest to us, of course, UT and BG, the I-75 rivalry. So we'll talk to those coaches respectively coming up here in just a couple of minutes right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
106 Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling along, are we? It is 4:35. Thanks so much for being with us this afternoon. We shift gears to college basketball once again as we get set to talk UT Rockets. Rockets have lost 3 of their last 4, 5 of their last 7, a couple of very, very tough, close losses just this past week. A 74-72 setback to Northern Illinois at home then, 81-80. At Ball State, and joining us now to talk about it is the head coach of the UT Rockets, Todd Kowalczyk, for his weekly look in at Rockets basketball. Coach, how are you this afternoon?
Good, Bob. How you doing?
I'm good. I'd be better, of course, as I'm sure you would, if we could just eke those nail biters out and turn them from L's to dubs. Let's start, if we could, Coach, and go back to Northern, since the last time we talked, it was coming off the win over Ohio U. Talk about that 74-72 loss to the Huskies.
Well, that was a game that I thought was there for us to be, to have. Started out the game well, let them back in the game. Didn't end the first half, probably the right way. But second half it was back and forth a little bit. I thought our offense or our defense rebounding in the first half and our turnovers really was the main problem. Had some bad turnovers and they had 10 offensive rebounds. They only had 2 in the second half. I thought we turned it around in the second half, but had some guys, playing that were sick, and it kind of carried over to some sickness we had on the Ball State game as well. John not playing at all. And that's certainly not to make an excuse, but it's that time of year where sometimes when you're down a guy like Zach Garver and a couple of guys get sick, it affects your rotations. It affects, the energy level, et cetera. And, lose by 2 to a pretty darn good Northern Illinois game at home and disappointed about it. The Ball State game, to be honest with you, I was extremely proud of our effort and how we played, our execution. Had chances to win. We led for 75% of that game. Had a stretch in the second half where we struggled to score a little bit. And that was really the difference. They had a mini run in the second half. From there we still had chances down the stretch, but played without John at all in that game, and thought our guys responded, in a tremendous fashion.
You know, Coach, it's and I'm glad to hear you say it. Every coach would say that. You know, there's no excuse. You know, it's got to be next man up, and you know, there's no excuse that one guy isn't there should necessarily mean you lose a game. But it's also true. I mean, if he's your leading scorer, he's playing, what, 33 minutes a game for you, and one of the leading, you know, floor generals, if you will, the leaders on the floor as well, it does matter when he's not there. So can you talk about what it's like to try to play without that guy, and then tell us where he is?
To be honest, we probably played better when he wasn't there versus when he was sick and playing against Northern. You know, that's where I probably didn't have the energy we needed. I thought we played much better, you know, when he didn't, just because, you know, he wasn't himself in the Northern game. At both ends, he still scored, but he wasn't quite himself.
He still played 37 minutes, I noticed, too. So
yeah.
He was dealing with it.
No question about that. And Steve Taylor's played sick the last two games. You know, Steve could not even speak on Tuesday. I had no voice, you know, because he has such a sore throat, and just, you know, he couldn't communicate, but ended up with 23 points and I think 18 rebounds. And they just had some man plays for us, you know, especially down the stretch. But Ball State's a good team. That's not taken away from them. They, sure. They're a very, very good team. They move the ball exceptionally well, but you know, I think, and basketball is so much different than football, where you got 9 Saturdays, 10 Saturdays. Basketball's a long year. You got to manage your season. And most college basketball coaches would tell you, you know, when you play well and lose, you as a coach, you can live with that if you're doing the right things. And Ball State was one of those examples. You know, I was proud of our guys, even, you know, despite, obviously, you're there to win the game. That's where our goal is. We're trying to win a game. But I thought we got better in that game. I thought we had some guys step up that maybe hadn't had the roles. Justin Roberts had his first career start and had a tremendous game defensively and offensively. Take away, you know, his a couple of his turnovers. He had a very good game, you know, and had some other guys really step up and play particularly well.
We are talking Rockets basketball this afternoon with head coach Todd Kowalczyk right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, Jim Cushlin, is with us as well. Jimmy, go ahead.
And you mentioned Coach Steve Taylor just a couple of minutes ago, and despite the losses and despite, as you're pointing out, his not fully there health-wise for Tuesday's game, what a couple of great games he had. Nearly has a triple-double in the loss to Northern Illinois, 7 points, 9 assists, but 17 rebounds. And then, as you mentioned, a 23-18 game points and boards in the loss to Ball State. So talk to me about his progression, and specifically out of these last two.
Yeah, he was not, you know, he could not practice today. Hopefully we'll get him back for tomorrow, you know, and be ready to roll for Saturday. But yeah, offensively he did some great things. The defense and rebounding, you know, speaks for itself. I mean, I think he might be number one in the country now in defensive rebounding. One or two. I think he was two going into the Ball State game, but, you know, with him having 17 rebounds, I don't know what, Caleb Swanigan did last night, but, you know, still got to get him better in our low post defense and obviously our ball screen defense. Those are the two areas defensively, that we've regressed, you know, since Zach has been out, is our ball screen defense, our low post defense. I've been happy with our perimeter defense. Jordan Moff has, you know, really done a great job, and so has Jalen Sanford. Our transition defense is light years better than it was last year. 3-point field goal percentage is way better. It's our ball screen defense, and that's where you know, Steve's got to get better. Just got to get a little more aggressive in our ball screen defense.
Coach, looking ahead now, it's a return of the rivalry. You get to play them a second time this year, which is good to see, of course. And I'm talking about Bowling Green at BG coming up on Saturday. In fact, we're going to talk with Coach Huger in a couple of minutes here to get his thoughts on this. But what are your thoughts on the matchup as you move ahead?
It's a big game, you know. It's a rivalry game, and you guys have heard me say it, you know, for years now. We look at this game as different. We're gonna our players have a particular, you know, interest in this game, and so do the fans, so do the media. You know, we're gonna compete, we're gonna prepare, you know, like we always do, but even more so. You know, and our guys will be ready for a great game down at Bowling Green on Saturday.
Coach Todd Kowalczyk, we always appreciate the time. Best of luck on getting things turned around with a win on Saturday, and then Eastern, of course, on Tuesday. And hopefully we'll be talking to you about a couple of wins when we talk again next Thursday. Sound good?
Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks very much, Coach. There's Coach Todd Kowalczyk joining us to talk about Rockets basketball. Of course, we will wish good luck in getting a win to Coach Huger in a couple of minutes as well, as they take on the Rockets. So we will have you covered on both sides of the I-75 rivalry. Coach Huger joins us next.
to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And welcome back into the Extravaganza, final episode here on this Thursday, and we're sticking with the college basketball theme. A split week for the Bowling Green Falcons, but a big win the other day at home against Miami, 83-72. Battle of I-75 Part 2 coming up on Saturday. This time it's at the Stro. That's a 3:30 pregame time, 4 o'clock tip, by the way, over on Talk Radio 100.7. And to talk all things Bowling Green basketball, we once again welcome in the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Michael Huger, joins us here on the program. How you doing, Coach?
I'm doing great, Jim. How about yourself?
Hey, not too bad. And as I mentioned, let's start right there. Let's start with the good news. A split week since we last talked with you. A loss to the Ohio Bobcats back on Saturday, but that is a tough, tough team. But then a win against one of the other rivals you guys have, the Miami Redhawks, 83-72. And when I look at how this game goes, the first thing that has to jump out at anyone, Wes Alsager's 25 points. He was just on it on this night.
Oh, yeah, he shot the ball extremely well from three. He was locked in, you know, from the first shot until the last shot. He was locked in and ready to go. And, you know, we needed that in the worst way. And hopefully that hot streak will carry over into Saturday's game against Toledo.
Yeah, 25 points in 35 minutes. He was 9 of 15 from the floor, 6 of 9 from three ball. When you know a specific guy is hot, do you sometimes, as the game goes along, make sure, hey, let's rework this play, maybe get it to him, he's got the hot hand? Do coaches ever do that?
Oh, we do it all the time. You know, the hot hand, we try to feed as much as possible, and, you know, we try to keep him hot, and we run some different things for him at that time. You know, we have a little package for him that we can run at any time during the game. So we definitely ran that package a little bit more once we saw that he was hot.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's obviously an important win. You guys want to try and keep pace as best you can. But it wasn't just Alsager. You guys, I thought, were decent rebounding the basketball. I love looking at offensive rebound numbers. You guys had the better of them in this game against Miami, 15-6. And, you know, turnovers a little high, 14, but you forced 24. So talk to me about the defensive effort in this one.
Defense was great. That triggers our offense. When we're locked in on the defensive end, great things happen for us offensively. The guys were definitely dialed in and forcing turnovers. We wanted to put as much pressure on their young guy, the freshman, Weathers, as we possibly could. And we were able to force him into 10 turnovers himself. So that was a huge number for your starting point guard to have 10 turnovers. And we were able to capitalize on that. And you know, you're not able to set your defense when you get live ball turnovers, and they had several live ball turnovers that led to our easy layup. So, you know, that was the difference in the game early, and we were able to sustain it in the second half.
We're talking with head coach Michael Huger of the Bowling Green Falcons. Falcons a winner a couple days ago, 83-72 over Miami. A split week since we last talked. The other game, a 96. Wait, where'd it go? There it is, a 96-72 loss to the Ohio Bobcats. Ohio hit 18 threes on that game. But one of the other small stories about that game, and to a degree about this Miami game, is you changed up the lineups a little bit, partly because there was a couple of guys suspended for a game. I'm not going to ask you to go into the details about exactly all of that, but these guys, some of these guys, Ishmael Ali and Zach Denny, among others, but these guys came back for the Miami game. But in these last two games, as a result of that, you've changed up your lineups. Inform me of some of the thinking of who went into what spots.
Well, we have a simple philosophy, attitude, commitment, class. That's our philosophy. Attitude, life is 10% what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. I always tell the guys, always have a positive attitude. Commitment, make a total and unconditional commitment to our program, to our academics, to our athletics, to our families. I always talk to them about that in class. I always tell them, always carry yourself in a first-class manner. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. You know, we had four guys that didn't carry themselves in a first-class manner, so that's where the suspension came in at. I had the other guys who, you know, always carried themselves in a first-class manner, and that's where the starting lineup came in at. It was, you know, those guys did everything I asked, and, you know, they did it to perfection against Miami. Against Ohio, it was something that, you know, first time starting, but they did what I wanted them to do. So that gave them the start for the for the next game. And, you know, against Miami, they did it again. So that will give them the start for the Toledo game. So that's just the difference in, you know, what's going on with that. And that's how my thinking was. And, you know, you got to earn that opportunity to start. You know, it's not a privilege to start. It's not a right to start. You have to earn it. And once you earn it, you have to keep it. Those guys didn't do that. And that's why they're coming off the bench.
And very well said, Coach, on that one. The only follow-up I can think of on that front is it sounds like you're going to take that kind of thing as a game-by-game, and if these guys earn their starting spots back, so be it. Or if the other guys, Roderick Caldwell among others, if they prove they could stay in the starting lineup, it sounds like you might keep them there, but it sounds like you're going to go by a game-by-game basis at this point.
And not necessarily game-by-game. I mean, for them, you know, they can have a bad game. You're allowed to have a bad game as a starter. It just can't be several of them, and that's the difference right there. So, you know, I'm not taking it as game by game. They'll start until they get beat out in practice or in their performance during the game, and it's on a consistent basis where it's happening every day. And you know, until that happens, you know, they'll continue to start.
One notation from the Ohio loss I do want to bring up, though, with you real quick. Dylan Fry, very nice ball game for him in the defeat. 24 points, 6 rebounds in 36 minutes. Got 3 threes out of 10 shots, 9 of 17 from the field. Talk to me about his game.
Oh, he's been coming along very nicely, shooting the ball extremely well, penetrating, finding his teammates, defending much better. He's actually rebounding much better. His rebounding is probably averaging about, since he started, probably about 5 to 6 rebounds a game. So he's doing a great job in the rebound department, and he pushes the break. When he gets that rebound, he can initiate the break and make great decisions. So I'm very pleased with how he's come along, and hopefully he'll continue to grow, you know, and become an all-conference player.
And incidentally, Fry had 7.6 rebounds. I love the 4 steals in the win the other night against Miami. We're talking with head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Michael Huger, here on the Extravaganza. A little bit of a college basketball update. Split week for the Bowling Green Falcons fell last weekend on Saturday to the Ohio Bobcats. That was a home game. And then the next home game was Tuesday, beating the Miami Redhawks 83-72. And as you mentioned a couple minutes ago, part 2 of the Battle of I-75 coming up on Saturday. Falcons, Rockets, this time the venue will be the Stroh Center. 3:30 the pregame time for the 4 o'clock tip-off over at Talk Radio 100.7 coming up on Saturday. And given where you are with the those players that we were talking about a few minutes ago and coming off the bench, and you indicated that you'll probably use the same starting lineup against the Rockets. What's interesting in a twisted way because of this is then if I'm hearing you correctly, Coach, Ali and Denny will be coming off the bench, and against a team in a rivalry game against a decent Rockets team, I almost kind of like that because it feels like the bench is a stronger unit for a game like that.
I mean, I don't look at it that way. I'm glad you do. It's just the guys that's out there. All I ask is give me energy and effort every time you're on the court. Give me 100% of both, and we'll be fine. And that's what those guys have been giving me. They haven't been trying to do too much. They've been locked in on the defensive end. And that's been the difference in a good start against Miami. They got us off to a great start against Miami, and the bench was able to come in and sustain that. So I expect the same thing against Toledo. If they can get us off to a great start, you know, with just the defensive energy that they bring, I think we'll be fine.
And in this game against the Rockets, it was 85-73 by the bye a couple of weeks ago in the first round of the rivalry battle. That one played at Savage. So you obviously, not just the rivalry, but you played them once already this year, so you know what they're going to be able to throw at you. So from that standpoint, in order to get a win and even up the season series, what do you guys have to do differently?
The main thing we have to do is take care of the ball. Play under control. We were really out of control, I thought, at Toledo. You know, the rivalry is made so big, such a big deal. It's hyped up so much, you know, that the guys get so caught up into it and wrapped up into it that they really can't function, you know. And it's really not a rivalry until we win one again. So, you know, right now it's a landslide Toledo's way. So we have to, you know, correct that first. And, you know, just take it as a game and not as, oh, it's so big and it's Toledo and we got to beat them. And then you put extra pressure on yourself and then you go out into the game with this extra pressure on your shoulder instead of being relaxed and just ready to play. So that's what I'm trying to get across to the guys. Hopefully they'll listen this time around. There's two times where we have not listened to that, and we just were out of control, you know. And, you know, hopefully we can be calm, much calmer, and hopefully it's the younger guys that will give us that calmness, because they don't know about the rivalry yet. It's not hyped up to them yet. It's not bigger than life yet, you know. So right now, you know, they'll give us the best chance, I think. So we'll see.
And that's an interesting, point to take on this one, Coach, to try to keep the guys calm and everything. At the same time, you want that Stroh Center to be nice and packed and loud for you, don't you?
Oh, yes. I want the Stroh to be nice, packed and loud, and us ready to perform in front of a great crowd. But, you know, ready to perform is the key words right there. You know, you want them to be ready and not overhyped, and now they see the crowd, and now you're doing things that you don't normally do because the crowd. Now you see a nice crowd, and you want to show the crowd that, hey, I'm really good, and now you're doing behind-the-back passes and, you know, all types of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want that. I want us to stay calm and poised, you know, and just ready to play basketball, because that's, at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's a basketball game.
And it'll be a fun one coming up on Saturday. Falcons, Rockets, Battle of I-75, Part 2 on the basketball court. Stroh Center is the venue, 3:30 the pregame, 4 o'clock the tip-off. Coming up on Saturday, you can catch that game as all the Bowling Green Falcons basketball games on our sister station, Talk Radio 100.7. Coach, best of luck out there in the rivalry game. Hope the guys are calm, and so we could be talking about a Bowling Green victory in the rivalry. To snap, if I'm not mistaken, a 6-game losing skid on the basketball court to these Rockets.
Yes, we look forward to it. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks so much for checking in, Coach. We'll catch up with you next week.
All right, have a good one.
That is head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, Michael Huger, taking a few minutes to talking with us here on the Extravaganza. And that's going to be the interesting twist. And obviously, as you heard there, Coach said, well, I'm not really thinking of it this way. But, yeah, guys like me are. I think it's an interesting advantage when you go to the reserves in this game, based on the fact that still as a result of their suspension, that was only a 1-game suspension for the Ohio game for the 4 players, for the reasons that Coach laid out. But bare minimum, the real ones to keep an eye on are Zach Denny and Ishmael Ali. They have been starters all season long. And as you heard Coach say, as a result of the effort from the other guys who've been starting in their place for Ohio and Miami, he felt that they played well enough. So Roderick Caldwell, among others, and Malik, they are going to end up starting again against the Rockets. And I do think that's a little bit of an advantage to Bowling Green, because you got two starter quality players in Denny and Ali who will be coming off the bench. And in certain situations, I feel if you can make your bench a little bit deeper and more talented, and because of this, they've accidentally had to do that, then I think that's going to possibly be an advantage, especially if they, as Coach is saying, can keep themselves calm and focused and not let the magnitude of the rivalry and what will hopefully be a very, very good crowd at Stroh Center coming up on Saturday afternoon to hopefully make sure that they can keep calm and composed. Either way, it'll be a fun one, folks. It's Battle of I-75 Part 2 on the basketball court. Question mark if we'll get a Part 3. Who knows? Maybe they'll match up in the MAC tournament coming up next month in March. We shall see. If they don't, this will be it for Bowling Green v. Toledo until football season. Hey, that's going to do it for this edition of the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. I'm in for Mike Miller on the other side for Drive Time here on this Thursday, so stick around for that, and we'll talk a lot more as we get you ready for the big game coming up on Sunday. We're going to talk a lot about that tomorrow, so stick around for Drive Time tonight. We'll talk some football tomorrow. And
step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.